uncertain whether he could continue through the emotion roiling through him.
"And Ayoko was the love of my life," he said finally, his voice cracking.
"The love of your life," Willa repeated in a whisper of amazement. They were not words that she had ever heard in the Dead Hollow lair, but she knew in her soul what they meant.
"Ayoka and I were married for 15 years, Nathaniel said.
As Willa gazed at him, all the connections came together in her mind like the water of the three rivers becoming one. Suddenly she could see all the pieces of the broken world.
"What's wrong?"
Nathaniel asked, seeing the troubled expression on her face. "How did Ayoka die?" she asked, her voice trembling. Nathaniel shook his head in discouragement. The wrinkled lines around his mouth and the pain in his eyes seemed to be filled with anger, sadness, and guilt all at once.
"I've been fighting the railroad and the loggers in every way I can," he said, "filing complaints with the county sheriff, disrupting town meetings, and trying to organize the other homesteaders to make a stand against them."
"And your land," she said.
"That's right," he said. "The loggers have come to hate me. But to make matters worse, my land here on the river blocks their path upstream, so they're unable to take their railroad farther up the mountain. They've been sending their enforcers up here, threatening me and my family, scaring off my livestock, sabotaging my mill, doing everything they can to shut me up or drive me out."
"But why? Why have they come here into our mountains?" Willa asked in dismay.
"They're enterprisers, businessmen," Nathaniel said. "They've cut down all the forests up in the north, so now they're moving through the southern mountains. They're meaning to come up here to Kleeman's Dome and cut these trees, too."
"Which trees?"
"All of them," he said in disgust. "They're clear cutters. They don't believe in picking and choosing, letting some grow and harvesting others. They take them all."
Willa swallowed hard, remembering the destruction. "I've seen it," she said.
"Then you know what I'm talking about," he said. "That's where all this began."
He shook his head again, holding his lips tightly together and breathing through his nose, as if he was trying to find the strength to continue.
"I started a fight I couldn't win," he said,
his voice grave and laced with regret. She could see that he was berating himself, racked with not just sadness, but guilt. There were so many questions swirling through her mind, and so many things she wanted to tell him, but through all that, all she could feel in her heart was a deep and abiding sorrow for what Nathaniel had been through. She could see that it had been bad. It had been unbearable to him. She knew she didn't want to hear the story, but she held on to his arm and said, "Tell me what happened to your wife." Chapter 52. Nathaniel stopped walking and turned slowly toward her. She thought he was going to look at her, but his head stayed down.
"A whole gang of them came into the house in the middle of the night," he said, his voice low and struggling. "There must have been 20 or 30 of them."
As he was talking, he just stared at the ground and shook his head, as if he was living through it all again in his mind.
"Ayoka and I tried to fight them. I got off several shots. I think I killed at least 2 of them, then tore into them with my fists. Scout got hold of one of them, too. I've never seen him fight so hard. But it was so dark, and then 4 of them grabbed hold of me."
When his words faltered and dwindled down to silence, Willis slowly touched his arm to let him know that she was still there for him, still listening. He raised his eyes and looked at her.
"I tried to fight back," he told her. "I tried to save Ayoka. I tried to save my children. But one of the attackers stabbed me with some sort of pack or spear, and the other hit me in the head with a club, and I went down hard."
He pressed his lips together and stared back down at the ground, pulling air in through his nose. Finally, he said,
"Then I was out."
"Your children," Willa said, her voice catching in her throat. That was what she had heard. He had said, "I tried to save my children."
"I've gone through it in my mind 1,000 times, he continued, "but I don't know what happened next. When I came to, it was morning, and my wife and children were gone."
A sickening feeling welled in Willa's stomach. She had to make sure that she truly understood what had happened. She had to hear the words in her ears, not just see the English letters scratched on plaques of wood in the meadow. "What were your children's names, Nathaniel?" she asked him. "Tell me their names."
"My daughter Hialeah was 12 years old, so strong and brave. I remember hearing her screaming in the other room, fighting to protect her little brothers."
Nathaniel paused, unable to continue for a moment. Willa felt her heart pumping pulses of blood through her body as she waited for the name she knew would come.
"My little baby boy, Inali, was just 5 years old. And my oldest boy was 10. We named him in honor of his great-great-grandfather. His name was Iskagua."
Willa knew he was going to say the name before he said it, but her stomach still tightened at the sound of it.
"Iska,"
Willa whispered in despair. She closed her eyes against the tears, just trying to breathe as intense heat filled her face with pain. She wanted to cry, to turn away and hide. It seemed so long ago, like a different world, like a different her. But she had left Nathaniel's son in the prison. She had left him there with the spear-stabbing guards and the teeth-chattering Yaters. Iska had been Nathaniel's son, and she had just left him there to die.
"Why did you say his name like that?" Nathaniel asked her. "That's what we called him. We called him Iska."
"I know," she said, her heart breaking. How could she tell him that she'd seen his son alive, that she had actually talked to him, but that she had abandoned him in a dark, vile prison to die alone? Her mind swam with confusion and guilt and fear. There were still so many things she didn't understand. "Tell me what happened next," she said, looking up at Nathaniel. "What happened when you discovered your wife and children were gone?"
"I looked all over the house for them. I thought maybe they had escaped or hid someplace. I knew that Ayoka would never give up fighting for the children. And Hialeah was a very resourceful girl. But Scout kept barking and pulling on me, telling me he was onto something."
"Onto what?" she asked.
"He could smell them," he said. "When he ran out the front door, I followed close. We tracked their scent across the yard and down to the river. And then, when we reached the bank, I saw..."
Nathaniel choked on his words so hard that he had to stop midway through his sentence. He pressed his face into his hands, pulled in a long, deep breath, and then exhaled.
"I've never felt pain like that in all my life,"
he said so softly that she almost couldn't hear it.
"I remember I collapsed onto my knees.
Tell me, Nathaniel,
Willa urged him.
The stones of the riverbank were spattered with blood, and my children's clothing lay all over the ground. That's when I realized what the attackers had done.
What? Willa asked in dismay. What did they do?
They killed them all and threw their bodies into the river, he said.
She began to say, but her words faltered. She was too shocked to speak.
They killed them all, he said again,
as if it was necessary for him to feel the full pain of it.
The night I broke into your house, she said.
I wasn't in my right mind, he said. And I haven't been since.
Down the river, she said. That's where you've been going every day.
That first morning, I started searching for them. I found my wife downstream, her body pinned against a rock under the water. I had to use a rope and pulley to get her out. I nearly drowned in the process. There was a point when the river was trying to pull me under that I wanted it to win. I wanted to let the river take me like it took her. I wanted to get out of this world.
But you didn't, she said softly, trying to find some hope in that.
I couldn't, he said. I hadn't found my children's bodies, so I couldn't go. Not yet. I couldn't stand the idea of my children in that cold water. When I finally got Ayoka out of the river, I carried her home, dug a grave in the meadow, and buried her. I kept her wedding ring because I knew she'd want me to have that, for us to be together.
Tell me what happened to your children, Willa said.
I was exhausted after digging Ayoka's grave, but I went back out and continued the search for my children's bodies. I've been looking for them every day since, scouring the banks of the river and the whirlpools and the deepest holes. But it feels like every day I don't find them, they slip farther away from me.
Nathaniel slowly shook his head.
I'm at a point where nothing has any meaning anymore, where it's time for me to leave this world. But I can't. I can't think straight. I can't do anything. I'll find no peace in my life or in my death until I find their bodies and can bury them beside their mother.
But there are four crosses, she said.
I couldn't let them go. Couldn't accept a world without them. It just didn't feel real. So I had a memorial service for them. Just Scout and me, trying to come to terms with what had happened. I put the crosses next to Ayoka's, and I prayed for their souls like I had found their bodies, like it was a real funeral. I thought that might help me to accept that they were gone, but it didn't.
Willa held his hands in hers as she listened to the words pouring out of him.
It just makes me angry, he said. Those loggers are still out there, still slashing down trees. I heard their infernal machines on the other side of the river this morning. Their scouting crews are getting closer every day. I haven't been able to stop them legally, but if they come anywhere near my land, I'm gonna raise a living hell like they've never seen. I went down to Gatlinburg looking for justice for my wife and children, but when I accused the railroaders and the loggers, the sheriff turned stone cold. He didn't believe a word of what I told him. He looked at me like I was crazy. Most of those men down there are bought and paid for. Too many people making good wages with the railroad and the lumber company to let anything get in the way of it. Their enforcers have started spreading rumors that they saw me beating my wife and hurting my children. Now the sheriff is investigating me for the crime of what happened to my family.
As she listened to his story, a thick and heavy feeling caught deep in Willa's throat. In this one moment, it felt as if she could see all the broken pieces of the world in a way that no one else could. And one of those broken pieces was her.
She knew that what Nathaniel thought happened hadn't happened. The loggers hadn't been the ones who attacked his family. And what the detectives thought happened hadn't happened either. Like the two men arguing whether the earth was flat or round, they were both wrong. The world was mountains. But how could she tell Nathaniel that her own people had attacked his family? How could she tell him that she had seen Iska in a night spirit prison and left him to die? If she told him what really happened, he'd go through the cruel pain of Iska's death all over again. It would destroy what little was left of his clinging soul. And it would shatter the life that she and Nathaniel had shared together for these last few weeks. She racked her mind trying to figure out if it was in any way possible that Iska could still be alive, that he could have somehow survived in the prison all this time. Why were the night spirits capturing and killing human beings? What use did the Padawan have for children? She tried to think back to what she'd seen in the lair. Who was the bronze-faced, gray-faced Padawan, the god of the clan? How was he able to hold such terrible power over those who had once been such a good and honorable people? She was so deep in the convolution of her own thoughts that when the dog burst into a fit of wild barking, she jumped in surprise.
"What is it, boy?"
Nathaniel asked Scout as the dog carried on barking, staring out into the forest. Willa's ear twitched. "Wait," she said, touching Nathaniel's arm to hold him still. "I hear it now, too." It was faint, but she could definitely hear the sound in the distance.
Thud. 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 "What are you hearing?"
Nathaniel said, the tension rising in his voice. The incessant pattern of the sound seeped into Willa's chest like black leeches.
Thud. Thud. Thud.
"I hear axes," she whispered.
Nathaniel's face filled with anger.
"It's those godforsaken loggers!"
He started walking fast toward the house, more upset than she'd ever seen him.
"What are you going to do?"
Willa asked in a panic as she hurried to catch up with him. He was in no condition to confront the loggers. Nathaniel stormed into the house, threw down his beekeeping equipment, and grabbed his gun.
"Come on, Willa,"
he said as he charged out of the house and headed into the forest.
"We're going after them."
Chapter 53
Nathaniel stormed out of the trees, gripping his loaded rifle in his hands, and bore down on the loggers. Scout charged with him, growling viciously. But Willa stayed in the undergrowth. She wasn't a fighter or a killer. She couldn't threaten or shout or intimidate. She'd be lucky if they could even see her. A crew of 20 stubble-faced, hard-bitten lumbermen had come with horses and a wagon full of saws, mauls, chains, and axes. They had already felled one beautiful black cherry tree. Half a dozen axemen were chopping off its limbs as the teamsters harnessed the horses. Two men with a 6-foot-long, jagged-toothed saw had already cut halfway through the trunk of a second tree, an old oak that looked as if it had stood for more than 150 years.
"Stop!" Nathaniel shouted. "This is my land! You have no right to cut these trees!"
One of the men, gripping his axe, walked up to Nathaniel and shouted,
"It's a free country, ain't it?"
into his face.
"We can do anything we feel like,"
another man said as he chopped the limbs of the tree.
"Isn't that what freedom means?" You don't have a permit to cut here, Nathaniel said.
An older man, grizzled and one-eyed, spat out a dark brown stream of chewing tobacco onto the ground.
We don't need no stinking permit. I'm Nathaniel Stedman, he said, facing off with the boss of the crew. I own this land.
It's forest, the boss said. No one owns the forest. It's public land. Free for taking.
Willa's muscles tensed as several of the other lumbermen walked up to stand in front of Nathaniel beside the boss. They weren't going to back down.
Ain't Nathaniel Stedman the name of the man who done beat his wife and killed her?
One of the lumbermen said.
Is that true?
The boss asked, squinting at Nathaniel's face.
That you? You kill your wife?
No, I didn't kill my wife, Nathaniel said. You can't just come in here and start cutting.
Who says I can't?
The boss said.
You? How you gonna stop me?
I've got a God-given right to protect my land, Nathaniel said, brandishing his rifle.
The man standing next to the boss slammed the butt of his axe into Nathaniel's face. Willa's whole body jolted with the shock of it. She lurched forward to help Nathaniel as he toppled to the ground. Scout charged in and bit the attacker, but the man kicked the dog in the head and swung his axe at him. Scout leapt back and dodged the blade, then sprang forward and clamped onto the man's wrist, snarling and biting. Nathaniel tried to scramble back up onto his feet, but three of the men rushed in. They kicked him in the sides and punched him with their tightened fists. They struck him with the handles of their tools. Willa cried out and tried to block their blows, but there was nothing she could do. They beat him, one punch after another. She felt every blow against Nathaniel's head like it was against her own. Every kick to his side struck her ribs. With tears smeared across her face and anger welling up inside her, she threw herself to the ground on all fours and gripped the thick roots of the nearby trees.
If you want to live, then you must help us, she shouted in the old language.
There was no kindness in her voice, no compassion. She was demanding this, screaming at the trees.
I know you can help him. Do it now, or you're all going to die from the cuts of their axes.
Driven by sheer desperation, Willa focused her mind down into the ground beneath her. She drew upon everything her mamma had taught her of the forest and the trees and the flow of the world. She intertwined all that she had learned on her own of the tendrils of growth and the bend of limbs. And she reached deep into her woodland spirit, weaving the most powerful woodcraft she could imagine in her mind. The earth, the water, the root, the trunk, the branch, the leaf. It was all hers. She called out a string of old Faerun words that had never had a meaning in the English and never would. They were the ancient phrases of her people, the summons of her ancestors to rouse the ire of the trees, to bring movement to roots that hadn't moved in 100 years. The tree roots that ran along the ground all around her and beneath the feet of the lumbermen began to vibrate in agitation. The roots creaked and bent, pushing against the ground around them. Then the roots broke up through the earth like long, quivering, clutching fingers. Willa sucked in a startled breath, astonished by what she had done. She pushed into her fear and carried on. The roots of the trees were moving to her command, like slithering snakes from the ground, twisting and grasping, trying to touch everything around them. They were the mire roots, the primeval spirits of the trees, coming to life. As the earth itself erupted around them, the eyes of the lumbermen went wide with terror. Their faces filled with expressions of shock. The writhing roots coiled around their legs, clamping onto knees and calves. The branches of the forest trees thrashed back and forth above their heads as if angered by a violent storm. One of the men tripped backward and fell. The mire roots intertwined his arms, his legs, his throat, sucking the life and nutrients out of him like he was the earth itself. His skin withered and cracked, his fingers shriveled into broken twigs, and his eyes turned into black seeds of what they had been. The other men shouted and screamed and tried to flee. In a fit of wild panic, one lumberman swung at a mire root with an axe, but the blade ricocheted away and struck deep into the shinbone of his companion. The man shrieked in agonizing pain and collapsed into the clutching death of the mire roots as the other men backed away in horror. Several of the men leapt onto horses and galloped away. Others just ran, but the one-eyed boss pulled the rifle from his horse's saddle and aimed at Nathaniel, thinking he was the cause of all that was happening. Scout charged forward and leapt at the man, just as he pulled the trigger. Chapter 54 Willa watched in relief as the terrified loggers fled in panic, tearing away by foot and by horse. When they were finally gone, she let go of the tree roots and collapsed to the ground in exhaustion. She lay in the dirt, shaking and gasping for breath, just holding on to the steadiness of the earth. The branches of the trees stopped thrashing. The roots retreated slowly back into the ground. The screaming storm of violence that had filled the world just moments before faded into an eerie silence. The badly wounded Nathaniel lay on the ground a few feet away, cradling his dog's limp body in his arms.
"No, not you, Scout,"
Nathaniel cried as he hugged his dog to his chest. There was blood and bruises all over Nathaniel's face and head, and she knew he must be in terrible pain, but he wrapped his arms around his dog and held him.
"Not you, boy, not you,"
he wept as he stroked Scout's head. And then Nathaniel looked over at her and met her eyes.
"We've got to help him, Willa. We've got to help him."
But Willa knew it was too late. The logger's gun had done its damage. Scout's spirit was gone. The last living member of Nathaniel's family was dead, taken from him by the forces of the world.
"I'm sorry," she said, as she wrapped her arms around Nathaniel. "I can't save him."
And Nathaniel wrapped his arms around her in return, holding her like she had never been held, holding her as if she were the very last being on earth he could hold on to. Chapter 55 After a long time lying on the ground with Nathaniel and Scout, Willa rose, and she pulled Nathaniel slowly up onto his feet. She put her shoulder under his arm, and they limped back to the house in silence. As he slumped down, bloody and wounded, into his bed, she tried to say gentle words to him that might soothe him, that might help him through the pain of his loss, but she knew that her words meant nothing. Nathaniel had suffered too much. He'd lost his wife, his children, and now his dog. She wanted to tell him that she'd seen Iska alive, to give him hope, to give him something he could cling to. But she knew she couldn't. Not at this moment. Not like this. After all the time that had passed, Iska was probably dead by now. She couldn't hurt Nathaniel with this new uncertainty, this new pain, the agony of knowing that he might have been able to save his son if he'd only known where he was. As she thought about what to do, she went out and gathered seal berries and herbs from the forest. When she returned, She applied poultices to his bloody cuts and bruises, trying to help him in any way she could. He lay in the bed without moving, his eyes glazed with hopelessness. She wondered again whether she should tell him about what she had seen in the prison. She knew it wasn't right to hide what she knew from him. But if she told him about seeing Iska in the Night Spirit lair, he'd drag his bleeding, damaged body up onto his feet, grab his rifle, and head up the mountain to find his son. It would be impossible to stop him. He'd go with or without her. But there was no way he could make it up through the ravines and ridges to Dead Hollow. And she couldn't bear the thought of him collapsing in exhaustion and lying dead and alone among the rocks. She couldn't bear the thought of the Yaders getting hold of him the way they had her grandmother. But as she wet a rag and cleaned the dirt and blood from the wound on Nathaniel's head, she was already beginning to see what she must do. She didn't want to do it. She didn't want to leave. She didn't want to go back up there to that dark place. She knew she was probably going to die. And if, by some thread of strength, Iska was still alive, and by the grace of the great mountain she managed to get him back to his father, then she knew what would happen next. And it would break her heart. From what she'd seen and experienced all her life in the withered lair of Dead Hollow, love was a rare and tenuous thing, families small and fragile and dying. Love was a thing that shattered. It was a thing that could not last. She had finally found in Nathaniel a place for her heart to live, and it felt like a shaded, magical forest dell unlike any other. But if she succeeded in returning Iska to him, and maybe even his other children if they were still alive, then she knew everything would change. Nathaniel would have his real family back, his human family, the family he'd been searching for and yearning for, the family he truly loved. His need for her and her strange night spirit ways would fade away like mist from the top of the mountain, all around her in one moment, then drifting away in the next, as if the great mountain was saying, "You've had enough now, little one. It's time for you to go." And she knew it was a pain she could not bear. But despite what was going to happen, she knew in her heart that she had to go. Nathaniel lay in his bed, broken and wounded, body and soul, mourning not just his dog Scout, but his beloved wife and children. Willa knew that one way or another, whether she lived or died up on the mountain, whether she succeeded or failed, this would be the last time she would ever see him, the last time she would ever touch his shoulder with her hand or hear his voice. As the man Nathaniel's eyes finally drifted shut, and he fell into a troubled sleep, she wanted to say, "Thank you," to him. Thank you for all that he had done for her, for the kindness he'd shown her that first night in the barn, and every day they'd been together since. And she wanted to say how sorry she was about everything that had happened, what had come before, and what had come after. But as she turned and went downstairs, she couldn't find a way to say any of these words or express any of these feelings in the new language or the old. And although he had taught her some of the English letters, she did not yet know how to write the sounds of feelings on the skin of trees. So she walked outside alone, made her way across the grass, and disappeared into the forest. It was just the way she had come. Chapter 56. Willa followed the edge of the river like she had many times before, but traveling upstream now, against the flow of fate, against the flow of time, back toward the world she came from. She made her way high up into the mountains, through the darkening forest as the mist rose up into the moonlit trees and the owls took wing. Hours later, she finally came to the rocky gorge that led into Dead Hollow. The Watcher, the weathered carcass of the upside-down tree wedged between the narrow walls of the ravine, loomed over the path, a black guardian against the enemies of the clan.
"And tonight, that's me," she thought.
She had told herself that she'd never come back to this dark and wretched place. But here she was again. She wanted to turn away, to skulk back down the mountain and slip quietly into her soft cocoon hanging in Nathaniel's room. She wanted to go back to Scout and pet his ears and run and play with him in the soaring groves of trees. But she knew she couldn't. Her life with Nathaniel and Scout had been destroyed by four symbols on a piece of wood and a logger's gun. She had no choice now. She knew what she had to do. But she felt the weight of it in the pit of her stomach as she watched bands of yaders and guards moving in and out of the entrance of the Dead Hollow lair like hornets around a nest. It struck her how the members of her clan always ventured out of the lair in groups. There is no I, only we. But when she had been a thieving yater, she liked to go out on her own, to use her own skills, and make her own decisions. She hadn't even realized at the time how much that had set her apart from the others, how infuriating and incomprehensible it had been to Gredic, and how suspicious it had seemed to the Padawan. "Now there is an I," she thought. "I, the Wood Witch, the Weaver, the Yater, the Thief. Move without a sound, steal without a trace. That's what I'm going to do. Steal without a trace. Just like old times." But as she gazed at the Watcher, she knew if she walked in through the front entrance of the lair, they'd swarm her and kill her on sight. And she suspected that the prison guards had probably found the crack in the stone she had used the last time. They were probably guarding it or had blocked it off. It was no use to her now. This time, she needed a different way in. Something small. Something quiet. And something that would reserve her strength for the battles to come. One of the things she had learned as a yater was that nights of thieving were long and filled with many perils. She pulled back into the forest and headed for a nearby stream to find some help. A short time later, she crept through the dripping understory of the blackened trees that grew along the back walls of the lair. The shuffling, tail-dragging movement of her new allies followed just behind her. When she finally came to the spot that she thought was nearest to the prison, she whispered, "Here," in the old language, touching her fingers to the base of the wall. The two beavers moved forward and started chewing, chomp after chomp with their sharp, strong teeth, cutting their way through the thick layers of interwoven sticks. Three of the beaver colony's young kits and two of the adults had been trapped and killed by the yaters for the bounty on their fur since she had last visited the colony. It seemed impossible, but the Farron of the Dead Hollow clan, who had once lived in harmony with all living things, had become their gravest enemy. "Thank you, my friends," she whispered when they finished boring a small hole through the wall for her to fit through. "It's going to get bad from here on, so you better get back to your lodge. Stay safe." As she crawled on her hands and knees through the dark, slimy hole, her stomach tightened. She loathed the smell of it, the closed-in feeling of it.
But how could she have stayed with Nathaniel knowing what she knew? How could she abandon Iska to the Night Spirit guards if he was still alive? He was Nathaniel's son. She crawled through several feet of densely layered sticks, then finally made it through to the other side. She slowly peeked her head out and looked around. The hole hadn't brought her directly into the prison, but into one of the lower tunnels of the lair. She checked one way and then the other for any signs of the guards. For now, her path looked clear.
"Move without a sound. Steal without a trace," she thought again as she crept carefully out of the hole and crouched down to the floor.
She stayed very still, listening for the faintest sounds in the distance, her quills oscillating, ready to detect the slightest movement coming in her direction. Every sense in her body was tuned to the take. She dashed up the tunnel quickly and quietly, scanning ahead. She reached one turn and then another, making her way toward the prison. It was hard to imagine that the boy Iska had survived very long in the cruel conditions she had seen him in. The prison guards had seemed determined to make sure he wouldn't last. The small hole they had crammed him into hadn't been much larger than his curled body, and the guards hadn't even been feeding him. It seemed even less likely that his brother and sister had survived. She'd seen no signs of them at all. But she had no choice now. For Nathaniel's sake, one way or another, whether they were alive or dead, she had to figure out what had happened to them, or Nathaniel would drive himself insane searching up and down the river for their bodies. If she could somehow find Iska in the prison and escape with him, it would be the greatest take a Yeater had ever achieved, to steal a human being right out from under the noses of the Night Spirit clan. She came to a corridor where she could hear the sounds of footsteps and voices just ahead. She stayed close to the wall and moved slowly forward. As she peered around the corner, a guard ran toward her, spear in hand. She threw herself to the wall, wove herself in, and disappeared just as the guard ran past her. Before she could even take a breath, two more guards came down the corridor dragging a screaming human girl behind them. The girl flailed her body in wild, jerking motions, lurching one way and then the other, trying to escape the guards, but the guards had clamped onto her wrists with their bony hands and would not let her go.
"What's wrong with this one?"
the larger of the two guards asked as they dragged the girl down the corridor.
"It keeps trying to escape," the other guard said. "Lorkin said that it wasn't cooperating, so we should throw it into the abyss."
Willa watched in horror as they pulled the screaming girl away. They were taking her toward the labyrinth, where they would heave her into the black void of the bottomless pit, and she would never be seen again. Willa's fists tightened and her jaw clenched. A desperate need to help the girl welled up inside her. But she didn't know what to do. She couldn't leap out in front of the guards and suddenly overpower them. She felt so helpless.
"Get what you came for," she told herself fiercely, trying to focus her mind. "Find your take and go."
She moved deeper into the prison, sneaking unseen and unheard from shadow to shadow, blending here and darting there. She soon found herself surrounded by wailing, captured children crammed into prison cells up and down the corridor, guards shouting at them through the lattices in the cell doors. Some of the children were wounded and weak, others strong and defiant and fighting back. But what struck her was that the humans were still here, and at least some of them were still alive. It seemed as if the guards were holding the various prisoners in different types of cells, feeding some extravagantly and starving others, talking to certain children in kind words, but then isolating the others in total darkness. She couldn't figure out why the guards were doing all this, but somehow it felt strangely familiar to her.
There was something about it that reminded her too keenly of her own nightmares.
"Just get what you came for," she told herself again and tried to continue on. "You're a thief. Find your take and go."
Deeper down in the prison, where there were no guards, she followed a long, winding tunnel with dozens of cells no larger than holes for curled-up bodies. Little human fingers reached out through the lattices of woven sticks as she went by. She tried to push her way through the dark, nightmarish confusion, but the sounds and smells were unbearable. Finally, she came to the cell she was looking for, where she had fed Iska the cookies. She crouched down and peered into the darkness of the hole. The body of a young, dark-haired boy lay crumpled on the floor.
"Wake up!" Willa whispered into the cell.
But the boy did not reply.
"Iska, wake up!"
she whispered again, louder this time. But the boy in the cell did not move. She looked up the corridor, knowing that a guard could come running in her direction at any moment, and then she turned back to the cell.
"Iska, it's me. It's Willa," she said. "You've got to get up. We've got to go."
But still, the crumpled shape in the cell did not move. She felt her world starting to close in, the heat rising to her face, and it was getting more and more difficult to breathe. Her hand trembled as she reached slowly into the darkness of the cell to touch the body. Chapter 57.
"Iska,"
she said again as she put her hand on the boy's shoulder. But he did not respond. She shook him to rouse him, to make sure he was all right. But still he did not move. She reached over and put her hand on his bare arm. His skin was cold. Too cold. She swallowed hard, and then she slowly withdrew her hand. She peered through the lattice of sticks, trying to get a different view of the boy lying on the floor in the cell. She had to see his face to be sure. "It looks like him, but the hair, maybe the hair isn't right. It's dark brown, not jet black like Iska's had been." When she finally found an angle where she could see some of the boy's face, she realized that it wasn't him. She didn't know who this poor, dead boy had been, but he wasn't Iska. But whoever he had been, he didn't belong here on the floor of this cell. There had to be someone out there looking for him, someone who loved him, someone like Nathaniel or her mamma, someone who had been a part of his life, and he a part of theirs. She looked down the corridor, her heart so overwhelmed with emotion that she couldn't stir herself to move. The only thing that brought her back was that none of this made sense. Why are they treating the various prisoners so differently? Why are they taking care of some but not others? What are they doing to them? What is the purpose of all this? As the questions raced through her mind, she remembered something from years before. She and Gredek were lying bloody and beaten on the forest floor on the first night of their initiation as Yaeters. She realized that the guards weren't treating some of the prisoners well and others badly. They were treating them all badly at first, breaking them down, then slowly feeding them and taking care of them, making them more and more dependent and obedient. "They're initiating them," Willa thought in horror. "They're adopting these children into the clan and turning them into Yaeters." And she knew the reason why. She had seen it all her life, in the crumbling ceiling of the Great Hall, in the echoing corridors and empty dens, in the stories her mamma had told her of the many years past. The Dead Hollow clan was dying. There had been fewer young ones born every year. When the Padawan took her into his rooms behind the throne, she had seen the fear in the depths of his mind and the lengths to which he would go to save the clan. He had adopted the tools and weapons of the humans. He had taken on their language. He had even started killing the animals of the forest, something no Farron of old would ever do. But even with all the changes he had made, the clan continued to wither year after year. She could see now that the Padawan had ordered the Night Spirit Guards to capture these human children for a purpose. If children weren't being born, they'd be stolen, brought up in the ways of the clan, and grafted into the Yater life by force. The Padawan would train them, just as he had trained her and Gretik and the others, with food and care and threat and violence, all in careful measure, until they were faithful servants of the clan. There is no I, only we. She hadn't had a choice about whether she was part of the Dead Hollow Lair. She hadn't had a choice about whether she wanted to be a Yater. And neither would they. But looking now at the body of the dead boy lying in the cell, she knew that some of these children weren't going to make it. They were going to die here. The guards would drag their bodies to the labyrinth and throw them into the black abyss. Hopelessness welled up inside her. She looked down the corridor of cells. How could she ever find Iska in all of this? How did she know he wasn't already dead and gone? Gathering up her strength, she moved down to the next cell and peered in. "Iska," she whispered, but without hope. A little girl groaned and looked up at her with pleading eyes. Willa felt a pang in her heart, but she knew she couldn't help the girl. There were just too many of them. "Get what you came for, Willa," she told herself again. "Get your take and go." She pushed herself on to the next cell. "Iska," she whispered. But every hole she looked into offered a new nightmare. Chapter 58. Willa checked cell after cell for Iska, but she could not find him. She went down one of the lower side corridors to a place where the cells were mostly empty. It seemed to be where they were isolating certain prisoners in an unused part of the prison. "Iska, are you here?" she whispered into the darkness. She didn't find him in those cells either. She went down another side corridor and kept looking, using her eyes, her nose, her ears, every sense in her Yater body focused on finding him. "Find your take, Willa," she kept thinking. "Iska," she whispered into the next cell, trying to keep her voice from losing hope. But the cell was empty. "Help me!" came a gasp from farther down the corridor. Willa ran forward to the cell door and looked into the hole. A pair of brown eyes peered out at her, filled with hope. "Iska," she said, her heart leaping with joy. "It's me," he said, their fingers touching through the lattice of sticks. "I'm so glad I found you," Willa said. "I knew you'd come back," Iska said excitedly. She could hear the sounds of Nathaniel's voice in his. Iska was so much a part of her now. And he was alive. Iska was actually alive. She didn't remember giving him any indication that she'd come back for him, but it broke her heart to think that he'd been waiting for her to return all this time. She pressed her fingers against his through the lattice of the interwoven sticks, just holding on to them. There was so much to tell him.
"Do you live in this place?" he asked. "Who are you? Where do you come from? Do you have food?"
"I'm a friend of your father's," she said, ignoring the rest. Iska's face flushed with relief and happiness.
"Is he all right? Where is he? Is he here?"
"No, but he's been looking for you."
"I knew he would be," Iska said, nodding his head.
The boy seemed to have been living on nothing but hope in his time here, hoping for her to bring him food, hoping for his father to rescue him. But Willa could hear in Iska's tone of voice that he had known it was quite possible that his father was dead.
"What about my mother?"
Iska asked, his voice ragged with fear. He seemed to already know what Willa was going to tell him.
"I'm sorry, Iska," she said, her voice trembling. "Your mother passed away the night you were captured."
She had seen the light in Nathaniel's eyes when he spoke of Iska's mother. She had seen the life Ayoka had lived with him in their home. She had cared for Ayoka's goats and her bees, and she had sat on Ayoka's grave and read her name. "Your father buried your mother in the meadow by the house," she said sadly. Iska's lips pressed together as he slowly nodded his head and wiped the tears dripping from his eyes.
"I saw her lying on the ground," he said, "by the river. I'm so sorry, Iska." "But who are these creatures?" he asked fiercely, looking at her through the lattice. "Where are we? What are they doing with us down here?"
"You're in the lair of the night spirits," she said. "They've been capturing human children."
"But I don't understand. What do they want with us?"
"For you to join them," she said gravely. It didn't seem possible, but she knew that was what they were doing.
"Join them?"
Iska said in horror. She was relieved to hear from the revulsion in his voice that there was still some fighting spirit inside him.
"I've come to get you out," she said, "to take you back to your father." "But I can't get out of this cell," Iska said. "I've been trying to dig through the sticks, but it's impossible."
"Step back away from the door," she said. As Iska followed her instructions, Willa put her hands on the door that separated them.
"You're not going to want to watch this. Turn your eyes away. Quickly now." "What are you going to do?" Iska asked,
but in that instant, the door boiled into a wall of writhing, undead sticks and collapsed onto the floor into a slimy pile of twisting black worms. Iska wrenched away in startled terror.
"Oh my God, what is that? I told you not to watch!"
Willa scolded him as she reached inside, grabbed his arm, and pulled him out of the cell.
"Come on,"
she said, gesturing for him to follow her up the corridor.
"We need to get my brother and sister," he said as he followed her. "I'm sorry, Iska," she said as they quickly turned a corner. "I haven't seen them." "I know they're here someplace," he said. "My sister wouldn't give up."
"But where are they?" she asked.
"Please, Willa," Iska said. "We can't leave without them."
Willa's stomach tightened as she looked uncertainly into the darkened bowels of the rest of the prison. She knew how difficult it was going to be to find two more prisoners in the chaos of all these cells and get them out alive. But she knew that if it was Aliyu who was imprisoned here, she could never leave her behind. It was the bond that could not be broken.
"All right, we'll start looking for them," she said, "starting down here in these side tunnels."
As they ran through the lower tunnels of the prison, searching from cell to cell, Willa's legs pumped beneath her, propelling her forward. Her eyes scanned ahead, looking for danger at every turn. Iska ran beside her, trying to keep up, and whispering his sister's name into the cells. The corridors of the prison had already been dangerous for her, but with Iska in tow, they were far more so now. His skin was alarmingly consistent in color from one moment to the next, and was sure to give them away.